The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm joined by Admiral Mark Montgomery, retired United States Navy. He is the author recently of an article in Defense One titled Guam Needs Better Missile Defenses Urgently. I wanted him to explain this to the audience at large. Good morning, Admiral. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, good morning, Hugh, and thank you for having me.
Now, Admiral, we've got Steelers fans listening, and they think Guam is made by Wrigley's. So we're going to start at the beginning, and Guam could tip over if we put too many Marines on it. What exactly is, where, and why do we care about Guam?
So Guam is a U.S. territory that is physically located in the Western Pacific. It's on what's called the second island chain. In other words, the second chain of islands away from the coast of China. It is a major U.S. military base. We have a large airfield there named Anderson Airfield. We used it during World War II. We used it during the Vietnam War. And we will undoubtedly have to use it if we get in a crisis or contingency with China. It also hosts a submarine facility, one of the only submarine base in the Western Pacific, and one of the few places where we could reload submarines in a wartime condition. And then finally, and not unimportantly, it's home to 170,000 U.S. citizens who expect to be defended in a conflict.
Well said. I would like to point out as well that airfields. If anyone saw Top Gun Maverick, and everyone saw Top Gun Maverick, judging by the box office, what did the United States Navy do first? It took out the airfields in the enemy, not named Iran, but Iran. First thing they did was cripple the airstrips. Why did they do that, Admiral?
Well, the criticality is to prevent the adversary planes from launching and taking on your aircraft. In the case of the Top Gun ones, the Iranian aircraft against the F-18s. For the United States, that is a critical base for establishing air supremacy in between the first and second island chains. But it's also where we would reload and launch refueling aircraft, potentially bombers, and certainly fighters. So it is a critical airfield to the Indo-PACOM commander's war plan for deterring or defeating China.
Now, Admiral, you had a very senior position in defending the Pacific, and I know you know this, but can you explain to people that just because China attacks Guam doesn't mean the world is ending? It's actually a likely target in a sub-nuclear conflict. Am I right in saying that?
I think you are. And, to make sure that we think that they think that, the Chinese have actually put together patriotic videos of Chinese weapon systems striking Guam and shown that widely inside the country into their military. They've certainly put it on the table, and certainly it's something that we have to plan for. If they don't strike Guam and they don't strike U.S. airfields in Japan, it is going to be the U.S. will eventually have its way with the Chinese.
Can you explain that?
We need two real strong capabilities to take on China. One is our submarines in an undersea warfare job where we really do have a strong asymmetric advantage. The problem, of course, is submarine warfare is very slow. So that we will slowly erode the Chinese Navy through losses from our submarines over time in a conflict. The way we can rapidly deal with the Chinese Navy, which is the critical force for them as they try to do a cross-strait invasion of Taiwan or an attack on the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea against Japan. The quick way of doing it is with long-range anti-ship cruise missiles launched from Air Force and Navy aircraft, principally Air Force, the B-1 and eventually the B-52, and then with the Navy from the F-18 and eventually the P-8. And to do that, you need airfields. And if you allow us to maintain airfields in Japan and in Guam, we will be able to maintain the air supremacy we need to allow our bombers and our refuelers to penetrate and strike Chinese targets.
Now, for those who do not know, Admiral Montgomery recently served as executive director to the Cyber Solarium, which focused on cyber vulnerability and cyber capability. This is a different realm. This is about the stuff that we are used to in Top Gun and that we as civilians understand will happen. But it is possible to deter a Chinese attack by hardening Guam, even though they now have these hypersonic multiple reentry vehicles that go backwards and I gather can do pirouettes, and we don't have any idea how to shoot them down. How do you stop that, Admiral?
Well, you're absolutely right. We're going to have to stop a lot of Chinese missiles. They have thousands of cruise missiles that can reach out to the first and second island chains. They have hundreds of land-based ballistic missiles that can reach out into the first and second island chains. And they're now developing hypersonic weapons. Now, we have systems to handle the first two, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, and we need to properly integrate them and place them on Guam, and that's what the article talked about. But you've referred to a third thing, the hypersonic missile. And there, we also talk about it in the article. What we say is, look, hypersonic defense is lagging hypersonic attack. Russia, China, and for that matter, the United States, have been going gangbusters on developing hypersonic attack weapons. And you read about it in the press all the time, and the Chinese have done quite a bit of testing. The Russians have done some testing, and now the U.S. is testing. Hypersonic defense is equally important because, particularly for the United States, who is the democracy, we're not the first mover. We're not the country, that the authoritarian nation that's going to strike first normally. You don't want the first mover, the authoritarian regime, to have a capability for which you have no defense. That puts deterrence in jeopardy. Therefore, it's critical that we get hypersonic deterrence going. What we recommend is that the Missile Defense Agency, an agency within the Department of Defense that's had some great successes over the years, that they be focused on tackling this hypersonic defense. They be given all the rapid acquisition authorities they need so they can get on this right away and help maintain deterrence in the Western Pacific.
You know, last month, Bud McFarland died, and Bud McFarland's role in promoting Strategic Defense Initiative back in the early 80s was not much covered. That's what we sort of need again. And people laughed at Reagan, right? And now everyone understands SDI was actually a smart thing. How long does it take us to get from where we are to where we need to be in terms of defense against hypersonics, Admiral Montgomery?
Well, in my opinion, if the Missile Defense Agency is given the proper resources and the rapid acquisition authorities that they had, for the first 20 years of their existence, you know, that they got in order to build the systems that we have right now to defend against North Korea. If they get those rapid acquisition authorities and they get the resources, they can get the job done over the next 3 to 5 years. And that's the right kind of window to bring the system online, just as the Chinese and Russian offensive systems are coming online. But any delay, you know, any delay by the Department of Defense thinking about it, slowing the process down, and that happens a lot, any delay by Congress in funding it, or any delay by the engineers at MDA making errors, is going to put us at risk. So we really need to get started now.
So if we were going to go to a serious response, we would not only add resources, we would add urgency, and we would keep adding resources and urgency, because I think, by the way, civilian talking, correct me, and I don't mind being completely wrong, that if you harden places like Guam and Japan, you deter war completely, because then they can't have the security of effectiveness with a first strike.
That's correct. The goal here, of course, is deterrence. The goal is to convince China not to attack because they don't know they can win. And that's about hardening our forces. That's about having deception, you know, mock forces and things like that. Blow up planes. They literally help, you know, as you spread them around. It's about demonstrating your willingness to fight. It's about having a credibility to your promises. And then finally, it's about making sure your partners and allies are strong. So the recent decisions by Japan to expand its defense budget significantly is a big deal. They're a very capable military that fights alongside us. The decisions to support Taiwan are equally important.
I also think DARPA matters, Admiral, and correct me here. If they think we've got secret stuff, and I saw Israel talking about their laser weapons, their directed energy weapons. If they think we've got it, it's like having it. But they won't think it unless we're actually building it, even if it doesn't work. Am I right?
That's right. So you're exactly right that one of our great advantages is the entrepreneurship and the creativity and the ingenuity of our engineers. And DARPA is the best example of it. There are some others, in the individual services. We have to be investing in those. So we recommend that we do a lot of experimentation. The Chinese will study this carefully, and they won't know for certain what we have. They'll just know we have a lot of it from their study. Two good examples are directed energy and high-power microwaves, for very close-in defense, frying a missile in its last little bit. But the other one is an old-school thing, dirigibles, putting them up in the sky. When they have a radar on board, they have a phenomenal look-down capability on inbound missiles, and they have an ability to detect the heat signature of some of other types of, some of the more advanced missiles that we're worried about. So dirigibles really give us an old school answer with a new school twist, could really help us here.
Now, let me go out on a limb here and ask you something, Admiral. It seems to me we have entered a new century and the Navy is the predominant service. And I know this upsets my friends in the Army and the Air Force, but it is all Navy stuff. Is the budget going to reflect what is a naval century and a space century?
So, sir, I'm going to correct you slightly. I'm going to say it is a naval and air fight. Is the J-3, the head of operations at U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, I looked at those as the Navy's probably about, 50 to 60% of the fight. The Air Force is about 40 to 50% of the fight. And the ground forces, Special Forces, Space Force are the rest. It is really the submarines and the Air Force and Navy aviation that are the big warfighters. So as we look at our budgets, you're exactly right. You have to make hard decisions. Just like during the wars in the Gulf and in Iraq and Afghanistan, as we plussed up our budget with what was called overseas contingency operations, it went predominantly to the ground forces. So we had an unequal budget process because we had an unequal threat or demand on the services. The Army was in demand. The Marine Corps was in demand. Well, we're now in a place where the Navy and the Air Force are in demand in our primary fight. So you do expect to see some shifting of resources. There was a slight shifting in the fiscal year 23 budget. I hope Congress continues that, and then the Department of Defense continues it in the 24, 25 budget. I'm not optimistic, though, that long-term will make the really big shifts that are probably...
Yeah, Admiral, it requires a Nixon to China moment, the anti-communist. It needs an Army general. It needs a General Milley to step up and say it's time to shift to the Navy. Isn't that what it really takes, is an admission from the Army that we got to shift?
Yeah, and yes, sir. And he actually has said that once or twice about a year ago. I think it probably comes out. It's hard to come out of his mouth. And he hasn't said it enough. And the budgets that we get from the department don't exactly reflect that. I mean, honestly, we need to be shrinking the size of the Army down to about 450,000 troops. That was the number the Army in its own quiet, not classified, but quiet studies determined in the 2016-2017 timeframe. But they continue to argue for 490,000 troops, and that money could be transferred to the Navy and Air Force and Space Force budgets and probably make a much more significant impact on our China warfight.
Faster, please. Admiral Montgomery, thank you so much. It's a great article. It's on my Twitter feed. I encourage everyone. I ask the Admiral to keep coming back and giving us that kind of smart analysis. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. I'm talking with Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander of Navy, former head of Southern Command, the author of many books, his most recent out today, To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. I want to move to the chapter about Lieutenant Commander Lloyd Bucher, Admiral. And I picked this up because when the Pueblo Incident app happened, I was 12 years old. And it's just very vivid in my memory as being the poor guys. And, of course, the North Koreans exploited them in the blinking of the eye. You tell the story I'd like you to tell the story again, but to answer a question, where was our air support?
Oh, Hugh, it was a disgraceful moment, in my view, for the U.S. Navy, in the sense that it was nowhere. And, of course, the story of Lloyd Bucher is a tragic one in so many different ways. He starts out as a diesel submariner. He gets surfaced at the end of the war. And then in 1968, he's in command of this tiny little intelligence gathering ship called the USS Pueblo. And it is operating in international waters, but off the coast of North Korea. And in the dead of winter, January 68, it's attacked by a variety of North Korean vessels and MiG-21 aircraft. Bucher is frantically trying to get air cover. He's frantically trying to get support there. And he is faced with a terrible decision. He has to, if you will, risk it all, because the Koreans surround the ship and say, look, we'll give you two choices. We can either sink the ship and machine gun any crew that float around in the water, or you can surrender the ship. He had no means to resist. Even the single 50 cal he had up forward was frozen in place. Anybody who went up to try and unfreeze it would have been a death mission, surrounded by Korean small boats. So he surrendered his ship. And as you know, Hugh, it was a deeply controversial thing for him to surrender the ship because of all the things we just talked about with John Paul Jones. The ethos of the Navy is we never give up the ship. We never surrender the ship. Your point, Oliver Hazard Perry, John Paul Jones, I've not yet begun to fight. But having said all that, and I've thought deeply and looked deeply at this case, I think that what it says in Navy regulations is you don't surrender the ship while you have means to resist. I feel as though at that moment, Bucher made the only decision available to him. Tragically, he came back to the United States eventually after a year of brutal torture. We finally got his crew released, and the Court of Inquiry recommended a court-martial. However, the Secretary of the Navy, John Chafee, intervened at that point, and I think it makes sense to do so. So he was not court-martialed, but he was, if you will, disgraced, retired from the Navy. It's a tragic story, and I titled the chapter in the book, I'll close here, with the title, No Way Out. There was no good answer for Lloyd Bucher.
Couple of key things. One, Chafee, who was the runner-up to Spiro Agnew, sadly, to be President Nixon's running mate, a Marine and a Marine's Marine and a great American. Secondly, I did not know until I read To Risk It All that it was 190 feet of water. So to scuttle the ship would not have put it beyond the reach of the North Koreans. That's a key detail. And I never knew until I read To Risk It All that this occurs almost simultaneously with the rather reckless effort by the North Koreans to assassinate the South Korean president. We are on the precipice, right, of a nuclear war. And I don't know, Bucher doesn't know this either, but history does have a way of, counterfactuals, as you present. Maybe we get planes there. Maybe they take out the Koreans after a sinking ship is too late to save. But generally, history must judge Bucher okay.
That's my view. And I think at the time there was a lot of emotion about this. And I talk in the book To Risk It All about working out one day down in the Pentagon with retired Vice Admiral Hal Bowen, who was the head of the Court of Inquiry. And I can't even remember how the subject came up. But I said to him, I was, I think, a lieutenant commander at the time. And I said, well, sir, you know, I think probably Bucher did the only thing he could do. And Hal Bowen, who is the most genial man in the world, turned and froze me with a look. He said, Jim, you just don't get it. He disgraced the Navy. He disgraced the nation. He failed us. And it was a hard thing to say. And again, Admiral Bowen, very fair-minded individual, but there was a lot of that kind of feeling in the Navy at that time.
Now, I want to move on to Captain Crozier, but first I want people to read To Risk It All for a lot of reasons. One of them is, I did not know until I read it, and you talked about your time as head of Southern Command and hostage rescues, that the casualties, the loss of life, is in excess of 50% of attempted hostage rescues. And I know O'Brien pretty well, who was the special envoy for hostage affairs. I did not know that. That certainly does color differently the go get 'em rhetoric you hear some places.
Yeah, this is just for everybody listening. Hostage rescue is the ultimate high risk, and it is not Tom Clancy, where somehow it all just turns out perfectly. And typically, the hostage holders will have somebody, a body man, right next to the hostages. If they hear or see anything, their instructions are 2 bullets in the head for each hostage, and it generally works, certainly more than half the time. So as you contemplate these rescue situations as a commander, which I had to do at Southern Command, you really want to move carefully before you risk it all, in this case, risking the lives of the hostages.
I'm going to continue my conversation with Admiral Stavridis about his brand new book, To Risk It All, 9 Conflicts in the Crucible of Decision. After the show, all of this conversation will appear on today's podcast, Highly Concentrated Hue, available at iTunes and wherever podcasts are. I encourage you to get the book, and I encourage you to come back tomorrow. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Jacob. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Talk to you on Friday on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.